interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Yeah, so, you know, I was there. The whole band was there in Duffels, Belgium, playing this festival called Brack Rock. And for whatever reason, like, you know, on this last album the band had put out, like, we did this whole occultish esoteric theme to it, you know. So lots, like, you know, we had candles on stage. It was like we had, like, our crew go out and, like, burn incense, like, in the front monitors and stuff, just to credit, kind of keep this crazy ambience, you know, everything is dark. But, like, for whatever reason, like, you know, the people, like, of this festival, like, we were like, let's get some smoke out there, put some smoke. So they turned it on and they put some smoke out there. And then we come out, do our intro and all this stuff. And as we start playing, the smoke machines come on. But, I mean, we're talking, like, all of them. And it was, you know, it felt like a five-alarm fire. You know, it looked like a five-alarm fire out there on stage. You couldn't see anything. I couldn't see the guys in my band. I couldn't see the crowd, you know. And then all of a sudden, I lose a stick, you know, and I'm feeling around the drum set for the stick. I'm trying to play with one hand. The guys in my band don't know. They can hear me missing notes left and right. And so the bass player's starting to, you know, mess up. And it was just one of those crazy things where I was just, like, literally playing blind and, like, feeling around on my floor tom for my stick bag. And it was just one of those things that you can only appreciate being behind that drum seat, you know, that you just, like,
yeah,
you know. And luckily, you know, you got a bunch of drunk, crazy Europeans, so, like, it you know, kind of wasn't that bad. But for me, I'm just like, when you lose those senses of losing sight of your guys, you know, and then you lose your drumstick, you really, really feel helpless in those situations.
Yeah. So you basically sound like Ski whenever he's rapping on the skins there. Like straight chaotic animal from Muppet Show or something.
Yeah, it was definitely pretty memorable.
So now, and that was with the Lillingtons, correct?
Or no? Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So Ski, we have, now, he just told you a story about the Lillingtons, right? So everybody out there, there's a lot of people who have already messaged us, and they know about the Lillingtons. They know about punk rock. They know about great bands. They know about the Midwest scene. But we're talking to Tim, drummer of the Lillingtons, but also is EMT with Colorado Springs Fire and is doing, like, some really, really, really cool stuff in the same vein as the theme of the Disruptors. Grew up skating, punk rock, loving life, being in the scene, and then almost like a second life of going on and getting trained up and now helping to save lives. And it gives me, like, goosebumps, man, when I start thinking about it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's kind of a strange world that we live in and how things kind of play out. You know, I think during high school, the only thing that I could ever, like, imagine was skating, playing drums, chasing girls, mm-hmm. you know, but, you know, going to punk shows. But, you know, I grew up in a pretty strict Mormon family. And so I was one of those guys that I grew up in a small town and, you know, you kind of had, like, your options, you know. You could have, you know, like, we had really, like, it was a really small knit community, but you had the kids that were always out trying to score weed or, you know, out drinking, you know, in their vehicles and stuff. And for our town, we had, like, a lot of kids that, like, you know, for as small it was, we had a lot of kids that died in alcohol related accidents. And so kind of scared me. And so I gravitated to the other side, which was people that, you know, were doing after school sports or, you know, and I wasn't a big sports guy, but the one thing that I stuck with my entire, you know, life since being a kid was Boy Scouts, you know, and I went on and got my Eagle and everything. And so growing up in that family and being in Boy Scouts, getting my Eagle, you know, always had that sense of pride about my country, you know, sense of pride of being patriotic and, you know, helping others, you know, which as you know, I get into high school, kind of segue, you know, as I got older and got more freedom from the family and kind of had the religious shackles cast off of me, so to speak, you know, and was able, like, just to kind of do my own thing. It's kind of when I dove headfirst into, you know, doing the band and playing shows and whatnot. But that growing up in Wyoming is like kind of like what instilled to me to have that sense of helping others and, you know, being at service to my fellow man.
Yeah, that dude, that's when I talk about punk rock and what it meant to me and that sort of thing. When you're talking about growing up in that environment of Boy Scouts and help, the main thing is like helping others. And I think that people, for some reason, and I know why there are like a lot of negative stereotypes with music and with just a punk rock hardcore scene or whatever. But this idea that when you're in the scene and you're listening to the music, it's telling you the same thing, like help others, change your scene. Or some of it can just be slapstick kind of funny stuff or tales of just growing up skating or whatever. But the core values, I think, like you were saying, when you grow up in that environment, they stick with you. So at some point they come back out or they resurface where you really say, hey, I've got this skill set or I've got this ability to help others and I got to do it now. Right.
Yeah, you know, in my household, my family always taught me to stick up for the weak, sit at the lunch table with the new kid, mm-hmm. you know, ask the not so pretty girl, you know, out to a dance or on a date, you know, to make sure that they feel included and stuff. And so mm-hmm. a lot of stuff at the time where, you know, I felt that, you know, nah, this is dumb. You know, it really made a lot of sense of like building a lot, you know, building my character, you know, and I see that now those were things that made me who I am today, you know, that play out in every situation when I come in contact with my community, you know, and I loved punk rock because punk rock, I grew up in small town Wyoming, you know, where we had the rednecks that, you know, cruise the loop, you know, on Friday night and threw, you know, beers at you, whatever and stuff, you know, and they were, you know, were like following just, they were kind of like following, you know, their stereotype of being a redneck, you know, because that's what they heard probably heard what other rednecks do, you know, they find mm-hmm. the people, the freaks and the geeks and bully and pick on them and stuff, you know. And so for me, punk rock was that place where it included everybody, you know. Mm-hmm. And I always like to think of punk rock, our community of punk rock and everybody that's involved in it or listens to it. I think of it as kind of like a wood screw, you know, that's like sitting like, you know, on a piece of wood. So, you know, when it's like drawn out, you know, when it's not even in, that's all inclusive to everybody. That's where we include everybody and everybody is included. And you're picking people up off the ground in the mosh pits and this mm-hmm. and that. And then as you get further into the subculture, you see that screw tightens a little bit. And for me, my feelings are as that screw tightens, we see a little bit of exclusivity, you know. So all of a sudden now we, you know, we got the, you know, like the juggalos or the metalheads are not, mm-hmm. they're not cool enough to be part of the circle now, you know, mm-hmm. and then you start to play in a band and that screw tightens a little bit more. And now the local bands aren't good enough to be in the circle, you know? And like I said, like, as I felt like, as I got deeper into, you know, punk rock and the subculture of it, is that screw tightened and tightened and tightened to where I felt like, you know, I can go as far as saying that even like as you get down to it, that law enforcement, you know, people that worked in law enforcement positions or first responder positions were not welcome in, you know, in mm-hmm. those tight circles. And so, yeah. you know, that's one thing I never, ever, ever believed in, you know? And so mm-hmm. I mean, there have been like friends that don't associate with me anymore because I've been, you know, I've been left outside the last tightening of their screw, you know? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I just, you know, and so for me, I've always believed that was an all inclusive, you know, place. And so unfortunately, as you know, we go on throughout the years, I feel like that screw gets tighter and tighter and the circle gets smaller and smaller to what is actually quote unquote punk rock.
Yeah, man, that's probably the best way you can explain it, because And Ski and I have talked about this ad nauseum with the whole idea of excluding anybody from a scene like that. That, and you're right. Like when I got into punk, when I was a kid, I was 10 years old when I got into it. And then that's what it preached was like, accept everyone, like be open-minded. Don't live like back then. It was like live by no labels. Right. Like just, you can't put me in a box. I can be whatever I want to be. And flash forward now, sadly, I don't tell everyone a cop. You know what I mean? Especially like at shows and stuff. I have to be very careful because I can talk to a band and the band will be cool as hell about it, right? Like the band will be like, oh, that's because they know I'm not a robot. They know like there are cops out there that have to put in work. You know, it's right. Just that's how it is. Like society will fall apart if we don't. And how cool is it that punk rock kids are growing up and becoming cops and EMTs and firefighters in the military and teachers, you know, like I'm at an H2O show not too long ago, maybe like about two years ago, right before the lockdown. I'm at this H2O show and this dude's standing beside me, like a high and tight, full tatted sleeved up arms, right? We just get to talking because we're about the same age. He's a principal of a school down in the South. And this cat grew up listening to all the Revelation Records bands, you know, Judge, Gorilla Biscuits, and then got into like a lot of other New York hardcore bands and stuff. And when we were talking, he's like, yeah, I'm a principal of a school. And he said that, like, that was his calling. He wanted to be a school teacher. And when he would go to shows and stuff and told people that, it was almost like people were like, well, I hated my teachers or I hated this or that. And then they exclude him. You know what I mean? It's like these stereotypes. And I hate that. That's the worst part about it is, and you're doing something that's absolutely amazing. Like you get on the scene somewhere and you help somebody and they will survive. You know what I mean? Like it gets down to life and death. And I think that I hope the scene will start to embrace that and say, and be proud of it and be like, that dude right there who just went out on that call played drums on this album that, you know, with the Lillingtons. I just, like, we should embrace it and be proud of it.
Yeah, I really hope it moves that way. I feel like, you know, I feel like there's an implosion of some sort that's, you know, that we have to go through before, you know, like something like that happens. But, you know, I honestly feel like, you know, as far as that community goes, we should be focused on the music, not focused on, you know, what, you know, what color I am, what I do for a living, you know, what's my financial status, you know, and, you know, and just focus on us all going to do the same thing, which is to be entertained by people who are making music, you know. Mm-hmm. And
are there any bands out there now that are trying to bring the scene back together?
I mean, I think everybody kind of every band always like flies that banner is that, you know, that they're here to, you know, change the world and unite, right, you know, the scene and whatnot. But again, you know, like this all has to also depend on like the biggest piece to the puzzle is the fans, is the actually people watching. And because we have, you know, social media now, we are able to watch and monitor what others are saying and doing when we're not at shows together. You know, and it could be like, oh, I talked to this really cool guy that was a principal down in the South, you know, at a school. And then let's say, you know, 2 days later, I've seen him on Facebook and, you know, might be like saying something that's not jiving with me. And then all of a sudden now it's like my whole opinion has changed of him. And you know, rather than just taking a moment and embracing that, I made a new friend inside the music community. And, you know, that view, you know, our opinions should be just that, our opinions, and, you know, we should be friends based on the music and not, you know, what color underwear we're wearing or what we're eating for dinner.
Yeah, or what coffee we drink.
Yeah.
Like I've legitimately heard people be like, oh, you drink Starbucks or you drink Black Rifle coffee? And it comes down to, we've said it before, it's like people argue over coffee, not because of the way it tastes, but because of what the companies are now starting to represent or whatever. And those are the things I worry about in society. We don't need to be so divided.
Here's the crazy part. Mm-hmm. It's 100% by design, but you can choose to feed into it or you can choose to ignore it.
Yeah. But unfortunately, like, you know, I feel like a lot of fans feel like that they're, and I've said it many times on social media that, you know, I'm here to entertain you. You paid a ticket and I'm here to play my drums for you. And that's all you get. You know, you did not pay a ticket price. You did not buy an album or a t-shirt. That does not give you access to anything else other than the entertainment part aspect of my life. You know, you don't get to know about family. You don't get to know about, you know, and like I said, I mean, and that's, I'm not saying that in a dick, you know, in a dickish way where I would not talk about family or, you know, somebody. It's just that there's not an entitlement to, you know, if my thoughts and opinions don't align with yours, that, you know, you got to throw your records in the trash and whatnot.
Well, what's interesting though, is music is such a gateway to connect people. But like, if you're really into music and like your favorite bands, you actually feel like, you know, these people, even though you've never had an interaction with them, like they become such a part of your life. If yeah. you're into a band that much, right? So you do kind of feel like you have some stake in of ownership in the band, or you feel like you actually know them. But again, it's a business at the end of the day, and it's a job to sit behind that drum kit. And obviously it's a love and a passion for you, but at the same time, like you said, man, you're an entertainer. That's what you do.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, Dolly Parton, she would never discuss politics, discuss religion. And she said it best. She was the one that said it. Like, you know, I watched an interview with Dolly Parton, and of all people, she was like, I am an entertainer. I am here to entertain you, you know, and that's where it stops. You know, we can be friends and we can talk about things outside that, but I hope that you do not judge me and our friendship or our relationship based upon how much my, you know, what I do, what I think, what, you know, how much that aligns with yours.
Yeah. The problem becomes that when people, like you said, they either overstep or they expect like you to one, stop whatever you're doing and share with them certain opinions. Or if they see it on social media and then, like you said, they say, oh, well, I don't like him. And I'm just using this hypothetically, but, oh, I don't like him because he shoots rifles and trains with these scary rifles. Now, therefore, he's part of fill in the stereotype, you know, this far right extremism or something.
Well, that's funny that you should mention that, because I had exactly that exact thing happen to me. So during the pandemic, you know, so throughout my entire life, the only like weapon that we ever had in our house was a shotgun that my dad gave me for home protection. And then when the pandemic hit, and I, you know, at one point, I got to tell everybody, at one point in my career, I weighed 380 pounds to the point where my band had an intervention with me and said, you are getting really big. You're eating out of control. You know, you're crushing a pizza by yourself. Like, we're really worried about you. And that really bothered me that, you know, my band like wanted to have this intervention because none of them were like perfect examples of health. So it was kind of like, well, if they're like worried about me, I got to be in some serious trouble. So
right.
discovered a gym, started going to a gym, and, you know, dropped some weight. You know, I went from 380 down to 275, and that gave me a lot of confidence. And then I discovered Krav Maga. So I started going to Krav. Mm-hmm. So I started doing Krav quite a bit on a weekly basis. And my coach was like, you ever done this before? And I was like, no, never. And stuff. Mm-hmm. He was like, I want you to come to one of our tactical classes. He's like, we teach tactical pistol, tactical rifle. He's like, for just never, ever being into this stuff. He's like, you have a knack for this. He's like, and so that kind of like opened up a door. I never thought about it. And so I called my dad up and I said, Dad, I need to have an AR. I need to have a long gun for this. I was like, do you have something? And he was like, well, I have this, but it wasn't exactly going to work. You know, he was like, we could build you one. And at that time, my knowledge in firearms was zero. So I didn't know that you could like actually build one. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was going to be sitting down there with all these little screws and whatnot, doing this tedious job of screw by screw. Right. So, you know, growing up, I never shared that interest with my dad of going out to the shooting range and shooting because I wanted to be skating and playing drums. Mm-hmm. You know, but I sat down with my dad and we built this long gun. And it was the first time, like, I felt like in a long time that I really shared a really awesome, you know, like father son moment with my dad. Mm-hmm. You know, we both like, and it was kind of like I finally connected with my dad on something that we both enjoy. Right. Yeah. And that opened up the world for me. But that's where I dove like head into it, that I was like, this was something that my dad loves, that my brother loves, that my brother-in-law loves, you know. And so I started going to tactical classes. I went to, you know, I started going to all these, you know, getting my, you know, my CC license, you know, getting, you know, just doing like night low light pistol, tactical rifle 1, 2, and 3, doing all of this stuff, you know. And then that's where I discovered our buddy Steve at Alpine Arms. Somebody online saw that I was doing all this stuff, and they're like, hey, I have a friend close to where you're at, and he teaches classes, and he's the real deal. He's like, you teach. And so hit him up. And then we found out that we were in the same bands. We knew some of the same people, you know, and we kind of just hit it off. And so I went down and did this Alpine Arms course, 3-day course and stuff. And it was great, you know, and I loved it, you know? And so that was kind of like the beginning of me wanting to, you know, be in some type of first responder, you know? So I was like, all right, I have all this, you know, firearm training. But then where I'm at, we have such a large military presence here, such a large military community. It's like, for a guy like me, like a civilian, it'd be very hard to get my foot in the door, because they have, it's like, you got your choice between the civilian who just, you know, took courses, or you got the guy who actually has got like real life experience in the field. Right. So I was kind of like, well, what else do I, you know, enjoy doing? And going back, reverting back to Boy Scouts and everything, I always was into like emergency preparedness, the first aid merit badges. I was a lifeguard, you know, when I was, you know, like, you know, a freshman through, you know, being a senior, I was like, and so I always loved that, the first aid and stuff. And so I was like, at first I was like, well, maybe, you know, an armed EMT, you know, like they have, you know, contracts, you could be in like an armed EMT or armed paramedic, I guess. So I started, you know, working for a lot. So I went through EMT school, and during EMT school, I quit going to the gym, because I was like, going to school with all these young kids, and I was like, man, I cannot let these kids show me up. I've never been to school past high school, you know. I was doing the punk band thing, you know, so I kind of just let the gym fall by the wayside, so I could focus on school, you know. And then I started putting the weight back on, because I wasn't going to the gym, you know. And then I got into EMS with Asteri EMS. That's where I'm at right now. Like, they have a, you know, it's a private ambulance service on the Air Force Academy. And so I worked with them for a year. And then this program opened up with Colorado Springs Fire, where they had this new program where they wanted to send out a strike team. They wanted 4 medics and 4 EMTs. And you pair up with, you're on an ALS rig. It's a paramedic and EMT. And basically I respond to like Bravo's, Charlie's, Delta calls. And those are like determined about like by the acuity of call, right? So what this does is I go out to any calls that are able to be handled by 2 people, by a paramedic and an EMT. And what that does is it leaves our engines and all the other apparatus in service to go to like actual things. So it's like, if like, say we have an engine that's dispatched to someone who's having an asthma attack, right? And then a fire drops in the district, right? They got to deal with the asthma attack. They can't go over to the fire. They have to deal with this call. And so our program allows like our engines to stay in service, you know, for the higher acuity things. But being part of the strike team, what that allows me to do is, one, work for City Fire, which is Springs Fire, is one of the hardest, one of the hardest agencies to get onto here. And it got my foot in the door. It gives me, you know, a lot of, you know, I'm running back-to-back calls, so it gives me a lot of hands-on experience, you know. And then it allows me to kind of see things like kind of like from afar of like, you know, where I want to go with my career, whether do I want to stay, go to paramedic school and stay on an ambulance, you know, and stay with this program. Do I want to go through Fire Academy and go to the line and, you know, put the wet stuff on the hot stuff, you know? So it gave me a lot of options, but the biggest thing it did was like, you know, it basically was kind of like made me realize like, I wish I would have done this sooner.
Yeah. Because, well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. Because like for me, I started not too late in police work, but I was a little bit older. I went to college. I went to the Army. And if I had started earlier, I could retire earlier. But also, it sounds like you're, what you're saying is like you come to a crossroads where you got to decide, am I going this route or this route? In either route, I've got to go through more training and get up to speed with that. But I mean, we're in an era now where you can do that at whatever age. You just got to have the will to do it, right?
Here's what's crazy from the outside.
You know, a lot of it, I think. Yep. I think for me,
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you're good.
You go ahead.
Damn, Skinny.
From the outside looking in, I'm like, how could you want to? Every guy wants to be a rock star, man. Like, who doesn't want to sit behind a drum kit and just go for it, right? And then, like, but the mindset that you have is like, I want to do something different. Like, right now in my life, I'm like, man, if I could find a job where I could be a rock star, I'd do it, man.
Well, I think there's like blessings and curses that come with that, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like buyer beware, you know? Like, the band is awesome. Being away from your family is not awesome. When you decide I say this very loosely so I don't offend our band people that are listening, but when I say when you decide to grow up, there's things that you're like, I don't want to be around that stuff. I don't want to be around, you know, the narcotics. I don't want to be around, it's pretty much like dive bar lifestyle 24/7, and that stuff gets old, man. It's like, you know, and for me, unfortunately, I could tell you like bands that, you know, there are bands out there that have not progressed in the last, since I have started my new career, you know, like I would say they're doing exactly the same thing. I could tell you they're probably sitting in the same bar right now, you know, talking to the same people, talking about the same tour and the same bands, you know, and for me, that's, you know, that was so stagnant, you know, and, you know, there was like a lot of things that had kind of played into this, you know, with our singer playing in two bands, you know, having to share him with this other band that was doing really well. I didn't like that, you know, kind of, I didn't want to feel like, you know, second fiddle, because these were the guys that I grew up with growing up as friends. This wasn't like the other band that, you know, they were scattered. They never grew up together. You know, they just came together to form this band, you know? And, you know, and I always thought like friendship would trump over the business, you know? And so I didn't like having to, you know, feel like, you know, when we would try to book a tour, like, oh, I can't do it because my other band's doing this and this is much bigger and better for this band. So this doesn't take precedence, you know? And so at a point, there was a point, you know, like early on prior to the, you know, the pandemic that, you know, we owned a screen print shop and that's what I was doing, playing in the band and come home from tour and print shirts or whatever. And I just was like, I don't want to print shirts. I'm just doing this to, you know, so I'm not out buying ridiculously stupid crap with the money I earned on tour. You know, I used to come home and it looked like that scene in Dumb and Dumber when Jim Carrey went to the store to buy groceries and he comes out with the big foam cowboy hat and pinwheels. That's how I was like, came home from tour. I would be like, I'm going to go over to Best Buy. And literally, this is a true story. I was going to Best Buy, literally buy a thumb drive. And I came out with a $500 drone and, you know, all the drone accessories. And guess what? That drone has never lifted air once.
Right.
So at what point in time, just backing up a little bit, obviously the music business is hard to make it in. There's a million bands out there. How old were you? And at what point in time did you guys realize like we have something here and we're actually gaining momentum?
Well, the thing about our band was, is that I always left and did things, you know, when things were slow, you know, and the guys in the band did that too. Like at one point when I was 23, I started the band. We started the band when I was 18. And by the time I was 23, I had toured like a lot. And I was already burned out on it, you know, and we had spent so much time in our van that we were pretty much sick of each other, you know? And so I was like, I need a break. And so I actually like told him, I was like, I'm leaving the band. And I left the band and I just needed a break from that stuff. And so I had nothing going on in my life. So I, you know, decided to serve my Mormon mission. You know, my parents had asked me, you know, three things: get your high school diploma, get your Eagle, and serve a mission, and we'll never ask anything else of you. So that was the only thing that I needed to cross off my little, you know, mom to-do list. And so I ended up going to Honduras and serving a mission in Honduras for 2 years. But that time gave me time to reflect on how much I missed the band. So when I got home, I wanted to do the band, but, you know, everybody else had started doing different things in their lives. So I ended up moving to Albuquerque, starting a hardcore band with my buddies called Stabbed and Back. And we did that for about 10 years. And, we, you know, just playing, you know, kind of like starting over with that project and trying to build that up. And, you know, and then at one point, you know, like it was kind of like we started talking more on the phone. I would go back up to Wyoming, hang out with them. And then all of a sudden, like Fat Records was like, hey, you know, if you guys decide to get back together, we would definitely would put out your record. And then Riot Fest, the festival in Chicago, they're pretty notorious for getting bands that haven't played in forever or are broken up to get together and play a show. And so they're like, we're going to pay you a stupid amount of money to come play a show, you know? And so we went and did it. And the turnout was so good and so positive that, you know, everybody's like, maybe we should start doing this again. So slowly it picked back up and we started doing it, you know, but like I said, as things progressed and went on, you know, it's like when you start realizing it's like, all right, I don't like dealing with the politics of all, you know, stuff. Like as the band got bigger, we had more hands in the cookie jar. We had more people influencing, and it's totally straight out of like the stuff you see like on movies or after school specials where you got the managers trying to take this member of the band away and being like, you're the real talent of the band. Let me influence you. And so you can go on and I can, you know, use you and manipulate you for, you know, whatever I need and stuff, you know? And so all that stuff is pretty like lame. So yeah. You know, I just kind of like started getting, you know, kind of like getting fed up with it. Then yeah. I just remember having like, we were playing a show in St. Louis. And after the show, we usually drive halfway. We're playing with 88 Fingers Louie the next night in Chicago. And we came across a guy waving us down in the freeway. And everybody's like, I was driving the van. And they're like, just go. And I was like, no, this guy needs help. And I stop. And he's like, you got to help me. She's over here in the field. I don't know what to do. So we pulled over on the freeway and it's like 3 a.m. and ran out. This kid had been driving and was texting on his phone and he wasn't paying attention. And he like merged over in the other lane and hit this van that had a husband and wife in it. And to make anything matters worse, this husband and wife were puppy transporters. What they would do is transport puppies from puppy mills all over the United States. That was their job, was puppy transportation. They had a van full of puppies. And this kid hit the van and sent them careening off the median, and the van flipped several times, ejected both of them from the vehicle. Good news was, I mean, it's a sad story, but not one puppy was hurt. All the puppies were fine. But he took me over to her, and she had, you know, a laceration from her, you know, like on the inside of her left thigh all the way up, you know. And I didn't have the knowledge then, but she had the agonal breathing going on. You know, she was doing the guppy breathing, and that's usually a sign that they're on their way out. You know, she had double pneumothorax. She had both her lungs crushed, and, you know, and the only thing I could do was try to like think back to Boy Scouts and my lifeguarding thing. And I was like, you know, he was like, we got to drag her over here. And I was like, nope, she's going to have a spinal injury. Don't, let's not move her. We're going to keep her here. Go get me a blanket, go get me a, you know, a sleeping bag or whatever, you know. And, you know, my band was all out there, but I felt like they were kind of just like, some were better than others, but for the most part, they were all kind of like deer in headlights, you know? So it's like trying to give them jobs to do, like, you go over there and keep that guy, that guy's hysterical. Go ask him if he's called 911 yet. You know, if he hasn't called 911, you go get a sleeping bag. You see if any puppies were ejected, you know, and, you know, and I could tell they were scared, you know, they were really, really scared and of the situation, you know, and I knelt down and I just held her hand and like told her, just keep breathing. You're doing great. Just keep breathing. They're almost here. They're almost here. And then when EMS showed up, you know, they came down, they put a Lucas on her, and I think they put the Lucas, they put on her for like 2 minutes, and then they took it off and white sheeted her, put a white sheet on her. She passed. And like, it's really upsetting to me. I mean, it was my first like death, like, you know, and so we're given a report and they're like, did you guys see this guy? And we're like, what guy? And they like had turned the floodlights on and the husband had been crushed under the van.
Oh,
man. And so I kind of got in the van and I, like I said, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm tired from playing. It's late at night. I just like my head just slumped on the steering wheel and I just started sobbing, you know, because like I was so upset that, you know, seeing that lady pass. And it was just like, for me, like I was gutted. And, you know, I was the rest of the tour, I had a week left of tour and it was really hard, but I found some peace and comfort. I was able to track down her family and talk to her family on the phone to let them know that I was there with her when she took her last breath, you know, and that she didn't die alone. You know? And that definitely brought some closure to me for the whole thing. But I always reflect on that whole scenario. I always see that stuff when I think about it, watching my guys and my band and the crew run around, you know, the median of the freeway in the middle of the night. And it just, I don't want to say I was disappointed in them, but there was something in me that was like, I felt really like we let these, I don't know. It's hard to say because I don't want to say I was disappointed, but at some point I lost something for those guys in my band because I was just like, these are guys that grew up in Wyoming and everybody talks macho, you know, everybody wants to be, I'm a man, you know, a man's man and stuff. And when it got down to it, I just felt like everybody choked, you know?
Yeah.
And I can't hold that against them. You know, I realize that some people just aren't, you know, cannot do that stuff. But at that, I think for me, that was like the beginning of the end because I reflected on that. And then I was like, I feel like, you know, I want to help people. I want to be prepared for that fit, you know? So I feel like that instance is also in a way like therapeutic for me going through EMT school and getting this knowledge as a way to let this gal know who passed away, if you know, wherever she is in the, you know, in the universe, you know, if she sees me and stuff, is that, you know, I went and got the knowledge so I can help. I wasn't able to help you, but I'm going to, you know, make that up to you by helping others.
Yeah.
Prepare yourself either for watching someone take their last breath, especially out, like not in a hospital bed, not somebody that's terminally ill, but like car accident, a shooting. I mean, that is, it is insane to watch because you realize, you know, we can talk life perspective all day, but you just realize how fragile we actually are as humans and how quickly it can come to an end, you know, because that could have been you, that could have been your bus, that could have been, it could be any of us at any time. But when you actually watch someone take their last breath, and go to the other side, that's not something that you just forget about. And yeah, as first responders, we've done that time and time and time again.
Yeah, it's life-changing. And, you know, when I was in Honduras, I saw a lot of gnarly things. You know, I saw, you know, a lot of people. I saw, you know, gang members, like they had the MASA down there and like watch them. They were using like, you know, chimbas, the homemade shotguns. I watch a kid get his, you know, throat blown open, you know, and stuff. And so I saw a lot of gore down there and this was just different. This just like pinged different on my radar because I feel like I was there at, you know, and I think in Honduras, they show all that stuff on the news anyway. So, you know, I feel like down there, like people, like they see death as just like, you know, it wouldn't be any different than seeing like an animal dying, you know. And so I feel like at that point when I was seeing that I was coming up, you know, seeing this gore, that I, you know, I was pretty desensitized to those types of situations. So it really didn't bother me, you know. But as far as like now into EMS, you know, I respond to a lot of the obvious deaths that happen in the city. So if there is like cardiac arrest, you know, or something, you know, where the apparatus doesn't need to be, you know, it doesn't need to be dispatched to it. You know, it's something that my medic and I can go out and do, you know. And I just had this conversation. They had a maintenance guy that found, you know, a guy that had OD'd, and he was really broken up about it. But, you know, and he was asking me, he was like, how do you guys do this? How do you deal with like the death, you know? And I said, well, it's not something we want to deal with. No one wants to deal with it, you know, but it's our job. And, you know, if we didn't do it, you know, I don't know, you know, it's just my job. And I always think, if I don't like stand up and do something, you know, is there going to be someone who is going to do it? Mm-hmm. You know, but I always told him, I said, for me, for every death call that I go on, I always like, I'm sad for the person, you know, but I also like look at the positivity for every death, you know, that I have to work on. Look at how many of the positive calls, how many people survive, you know, and that outweighs the negative. You know, there's way more positive calls where, you know, we have treated and released people or, you know, saved people, you know, then we've had to, you know, have lost them, you know. And I said, and that outweighs. And I said, and also I said, I always try to look at things in a very scientific way. We are all going to pass, and we don't know when or where or how, but it is going to happen. That is inevitable. But that should give you some, you know, like, you know, positive reinforcement to focus on what you're doing now, where you're at in life, who's in your life, and make sure that you make the most of it.
And the compartmentalizing, like some people can't do it. Like you're saying, like I have to compartmentalize everything. I've worked homicides off and on for years. So, and on patrol, you see car crashes. I saw a lot more gunshots and trauma from edged weapons and stuff than I ever saw car crashes. But the car crashes bother me because it didn't make sense. Like you were saying earlier, like you, and I was talking to someone recently about one that, and as we were talking, I guess something changed in my face. Whatever, micro expressions changed because I flashed back to seeing four young men burning up in a car. And I hadn't thought about it in, you know, 15 years, but during the conversation, it triggered it. And that was one of the things that I thought about. I was like, there's a lot of things that I push away and don't bring to the forefront of my brain or think about it in a daily basis. You compartmentalize it, you move on, and you try, like kind of like you said, more scientific, like you try to understand, this is what I do. Like if it's a homicide, then if I get emotional about it, it's going to mess up my thought process. So I have to think about things in like a puzzle, and I have to look at everything objectively, because the emotional side can burn you out in a very short amount of time when you could be working 20, 30, 40 hours straight trying to get ahead of this case and potentially work with a team to get somebody arrested before the next murder happens or the next gang shooting or whatever. And one of the things I wanted to say earlier about the collision that you rolled up on is the idea of helplessness and helpfulness. The whole idea that when you got there on scene, you may have felt overwhelmed or like, what do I do? And you did, like you said, you didn't have maybe the proper training, but you at least had enough training or at least experiences growing up that you have to do something. So no matter what you were doing, you're like, I'm doing the best I got, and this is what I've got, you know? So it's one of those ideas that there are people in the world that wouldn't do anything. And it's not that they're bad people. They just get overwhelmed or they don't know what to do or they've never even thought about that. Like there are people who have never thought how to splint a leg or do whatever it is. Like in their world, they never think they're going to roll up and have to help someone medically. But the whole idea of you then taking that and then going through the training and becoming an EMT, like that's what I said earlier. It does give me chills, like all jokes aside. this world or this field that we get into, helping others, no matter what it is important. And it's one of those things that I really, really, really hope people take it to heart. And anybody out there who says, hey, I like this, like I feel like him, I feel like I want to help people, then go do it. You know what I'm saying? Like go become an EMT.
I'm going to make a public service announcement for everybody listening. If you do one thing, buy about 5 tourniquets, keep them everywhere you go, teach everybody in your family how to apply one properly. And that can and will save a life if you're ever in a situation. Those arterial bleeds and all that, they can be stopped. And it's very simple. It's very basic. And you can buy, 5 tourniquets for $100 or something.
Absolutely. I think, you know, our family, you know, we each have, you know, our own IFACs, you know, and we carry our IFACs when we go places. And just because you know, like I roll up on so much stuff now that, you know, the proof's in the pudding, that you never know when something is going to go down.
You know, for everyone listening, explain what an IFAC is.
So it's just like your individual first aid kit. And basically the IFAC it's designed technically for you. So like, you know, if I'm carrying an IFAC and say something was to happen, that whoever was, you know, treating me, you know, should be able to get in there and pull that stuff out and use it on me. But, you know, no one ever, there's no rules about your IFAC that it has to be just, you know, I'm sure if I had an IFAC on me and I saw the, you know, somebody go down, I would pull that stuff out and use it for them, you know. But I, you know, we definitely got really serious about, you know, having that stuff in our home and having that stuff available, you know, because like, you know, stuff happens everywhere. I remember, you know, not too long ago, we just had that Club Q shooting, and I got off 3 hours before that happened. And I woke up to so many text messages, you know, on my, EMT instructor, I became pretty close with her and her husband, and came like second parents to me. And their son was actually like involved in that shooting, was there. They were celebrating. That was his birthday why those people were there celebrating. And he was actually shielded by a girl who was shot and killed, you know, like he was behind the girl and the girl in front of him was shot and killed. And a very, very, very sad situation. But it's like, you know, I never, ever thought, you know, we had the Planned Parenthood shooting here. We had the New Life Church shooting here. We had, you know, a very bad airline crash back, you know, before I ever lived here. But I kind of figured this city was done for its, you know, some for stuff like that happening, you know. But obviously, it just goes to show that, you know, it doesn't matter. It could happen 100 times. It could happen tonight, you know. And the only thing that we have control of is whether we're prepared to, you know, to help people.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that I think everybody in cities and even in the suburbs start falling in that trap, kind of like what you just said, where they feel like these events won't happen here, wherever they are, or, oh, we just had one, so therefore we're good to go. You know, it'll be a while before we have another major event. Mm-hmm. I mean, hell, unfortunately, it's like lightning striking. It could just keep happening. It doesn't matter where you are or what size the city is or how small the city is. It's everywhere. But there is a huge movement to doing medical training, to getting a mindset of, okay, if this kicks off, this is what we're going to do, you know? So it is interesting. Like Americans are changing their behavior, at least in that sense. And there's a lot more training out there. And there are a lot of people that I know now are taking these classes through different training departments or agencies or whatever. And they're loving it because now they don't have that anxiety of, oh, what do I do if I get injured or get in a car crash or someone else gets in a car crash? Like, yeah, boom, this is what you do.
Ironically enough, everybody spends their money on CQB and low light classes and buying handguns, rifles, and ammo, which I mean, I love that as well. But you know, you're gonna save a hell of a lot more lives with a tourniquet and basic first response or first aid knowledge and, you know, how to
yeah, I mean, wholeheartedly. I feel like that's how, like, you know, going from the tactical training and everything led me into this, because it was like, all right, I have this piece that I went and you know, done, but what else can I do to make myself even more prepared? You know, the medical side, you know, I'm, you know, if I have an active shooter, or, you know, do I know how to put a chest seal on, mm-hmm. you know, but, and, you know, and like I said, medical things, 911 emergencies are more likely to, you know, like medical and car crashes, all that type of stuff happens every single day, you know, and we should be looking a little bit more closely of being prepared for those situations versus of, are we having a breakdown of society, and am I going to have to pull out a plate carrier and my long gun, you know?
Yeah. You know, a very, very intelligent person, he's a college professor, asked me one day, this is years ago, he'll probably 10 years ago, but it was right around or right after Katrina, Hurricane Katrina. But it was a long before all these riots and COVID, obviously. But he had asked me, why does, and he was kind of laughing about it, but he said, why does any citizen need a rifle? And then he said assault rifle, but a rifle is a rifle. But he was like, why does any citizen need an assault rifle? He asked me a serious question. He's laughing about it, but it was a serious question. And that's the way I answered, was like, well, if you've ever been in any civil unrest, any time when a riot occurs or power goes down and people begin to come take things from their neighbors, you're going to need a rifle for home defense in that sense, because the shotgun is good, but you let five or six people come to your property and decide they're going to take whatever they want, and you don't know what it is. You need that for protection. And also I said, and also, I mean, sadly, you, it's your right, so you have it. And you never know when you're going to be targeted, when someone is going to decide you're their enemy, no matter what it is. Either it's through something that happens on the job. Nowadays, it could be something from social media, but you start to have someone stalk you or threaten you, and you have to protect yourself. A rifle is a pretty amazing tool. You know what I mean? Not to mention.
I wholeheartedly agree with you. When people ask me that question, so like kind of like, you know, coming full circle back to building the guns, you know, like at that time when I started doing the tactical training, you know, I was pretty like stoked on the whole thing, getting into it, pretty proud of everything I was doing, you know, and I was talking about it on social media, you know, and like I had like fans like, you know, unfriend me, had fans like, you know, write me hateful messages, you know, had a guy who said, why don't you take that gun and, you know, put it in your mouth and pull the trigger, you know, and it was all because like they were so anti, you know, gun, you know, the thing. And then people were like, why did you do this? And I said, because I care about my family. And let's face it, like someone enters my home.
Yeah,
you guys still there?
Yeah, yeah. We're here. Yeah,
all right. My screen. Yeah, it went down. So you know, I just basically told him, you know, let's face it, when you call 911 and that gets dispatched, that's going to take, you know, for the closest unit to respond, it's going to take a couple minutes. Those couple minutes could very well decide whether I get to, you know, stay alive, or my wife gets to stay alive, or, you know, or whatnot. You know, I want to have any advantage, you know, in that situation, you know, and all I'm asking is that have that chance to be able to defend myself until, you know, I think for me, it's my responsibility to, you know, and my, the same thing, you know, it's their responsibility also to look out for our family, you know? So, I always tell people, I have those in my house because I want the opportunity to defend my home while I'm waiting, you know?
Yeah. My thing is, I grew up around guns. My mom and dad split when I was about five or six, but I would go see them on the weekends. And when I was in second grade, he bought me a Ruger 10/22 rifle and a little 30 round magazine. Right. And then you have like these little 10 round magazines. we would go shooting. He taught me all the proper firearms safety handling, and we would go shooting. And so firearms were, you had respect for them. You didn't run around pointing them at anybody. So I just kind of grew up around firearms, and that was the logic of it. Was like, one, it's self-protection. And then two, it's you for future reference, you never know what the future is going to be like. And sadly, now we're seeing it, what happens in society when we begin to riot, when cities begin to come close to falling. And I don't want to go off on a tangent about that, but it is very scary to watch families in very violent areas where gangs know they can capitalize on that. And during some of the riots, 2 years ago now, I had an informant texting me messages how the gangs, what they were doing, and they were going to loot certain stores. So at that point, it was just property. They were going to go in, hit jewelry stores or hit clothing stores, steal this stuff because they knew we were all tied up with the riots. But we knew the location they were going to take the stuff and sell it. So, but my thing is, like, all it does is if that stuff continues, then those certain gangs go, well, we're kind of tired of stealing property. We're going to go ahead and go on the offense and shoot up our enemies or take out our people. Or you mentioned Honduras. You look at Honduras, El Salvador, such an influx of American gangsters, guys that grew up or came across the border from El Salvador, especially like when you study MS-13. These guys were brought into America when they were little, you know, 5, 6 years old. They grew up in L.A., became gang members, and then L.A. during the 90s, you know, were doing a lot of deportation to try to break up that violence. Those guys get to El Salvador and become, you know, reigning champs down there. And they're going head to head with the police departments, like a straight up war, because they were so ingrained in this gangster lifestyle here that in El Salvador, when they first started getting deported, El Salvador didn't have those gangs. So they were not prepared for that. Yep. And it became absolutely horrible. And I can only imagine what it's like as a citizen. And you see these dudes cutting off heads of people and you have no way of defending yourself or your family. Horrible.
Yep. That's all I want. Yeah. It's all I want is that chance to defend my family, you know, mm-hmm. And that cost me some fans. You know, I had some of like people in there like that were on the business side of our band, like, you know, like people from record labels or whatever, they all distanced themselves from me. But that's where I kind of felt like I realized, well, you know, these people weren't like actual friends. These were like people who were just there because, you know, we're making money together, you know? And so for me, I was like, you know, not a super big loss, you know, but it, mm-hmm. it does bum you out that you would like to, you know, not make everybody happy. Mm-hmm. We unfortunately can't make everybody happy with what we do. And that's why I tell people you're not entitled to that private life and what I do outside, you know, the entertainment part of things, you know, but you know, the band was good. I was very blessed to be able to go to a lot of places, play for a lot of fit people, check a lot of things off, you know, kind of like stick my nose up to my history teacher who said that, you know, the band's not going to go anywhere, you know? So that, you know, all that stuff was cool, but you know, I feel like, you know, for me personally, I mean, some people are very happy with just being, I don't want to say ordinary, you know, but for me, my life is very full of very colorful, you know, book, you know, full of different mm-hmm. chapters, you know, and that's all I've ever known in my life is that I go and, you know, I'm starting this new chapter and make this chapter just as exciting and great as, you know, so I always tell people, you know, I might be just a, you know, an EMT right now, but it's like, listen, throughout my, you know, my career as a drummer, you know, I rose to the level of being sponsored by one of the biggest drum companies in the world. You know, I had my name on my drumsticks. I was like, just imagine that type of passion that I'm going to put into EMS.
Yes. You know? Yeah. So, I love that, dude.
So hey,
let me ask you this, man. We'll switch gears a little bit unless you wanted to wrap something up. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's all right.
But if you're going to sit down on your kit right now and you're going to cover any song, what's the first song that you're covering?
Minor Threat by Minor Threat.
Oh,
nice.
That's what I'm talking about, Ski. That's what I'm talking. Dude, I talked to a dude less than a week ago. He discovered Minor Threat because we were talking about it. And loves In My Eyes. And it was just, I was like, man, Minor Threat is the reason I am who I am today. Damn. I just that banged
with,
my foot.
That was with no hesitation, too, yep. Man. That's badass. Mm. And did you like playing?
Yeah, that is my.
Did you like playing in the hardcore band or the punk band better? Like, what style of music?
Well, like with the Lillingtons, like I was always in. Like, I grew up on Bad Religion and Minor Threat and Dead Kennedys.
Right.
And so I wasn't introduced to bands like the Queers or Screeching Weasel, you know, until I had like met the other guys in the Lillingtons. And like with Wyoming, you know, like I actually lived in a different, I lived 70 miles from these guys, you know? So I would drive up every weekend, you know, drive up Friday night, practice Saturday, Sunday, come home Sunday, go back to school or whatever. But that's where that stuff was introduced to me and stuff was the, you know, the whole pop punk genre and stuff, you know, and in Wyoming, again, being all inclusive, and being young and stuff, it's kind of like you latch on to those people because they're also just, you know, outcasts just like you. And so, you know, I kind of just like, you know, grew into that stuff because that's what my friends, you know, that ended up starting the band with, that's what they were into, you know. But when I did Stab Them Back, that was more like I was in charge of that. Me and my friend Dustin, I got conned him into moving from Wyoming to New Mexico with me. And I always say conned, it's always a joke between us and stuff, but got him to come with me. And we started this band together. And we were like, we want an old school, like DC hardcore style. Mm-hmm. And over the years, like Stand Bag was a band for over 10 years, but it even that sound morphed because like, as like the lineup changed, you know, we had other influences came in and it became more of a, like we started to adopt the more like modern, like, you know, a punk sound and, you know, like had a little bit more pop thrown in and stuff, you know, and that was like, rather than being like, no, this is the sound that we're going to stick with, you know, I kind of just was like at the point where it's like, I need to let things happen naturally and organically, you know, so everybody's happy and everybody's wanting to be in the band, you know? And so I think we did a really good job with it. But I do love hardcore. You know, when I'm at the gym, Comeback Kids, my band of choice, when I'm lifting weights, yeah. You know, and
that's a really good band,
you know, but right now I have a group of guys here in town. We keep talk. We're a lot of talk. We're just old dudes that talk a lot of shit, but like there, you know, we have this idea, like we have this thing. I got other firefighters and medics that are into punk and play instruments that we wanted to put this band together called Responder, you know, and we wanted it to be just a straight up like hardcore band, like Minor Threat, you know, very gritty hardcore mm-hmm. band, but also like bringing with it that whole positive, you know, influence, you know, and, you know, really be like, you know, our niche was going to be like, we're all first responders and this is our outlet, you know, from after running calls and stuff, you know, but it's still like, we've been talking about it for over a year now. And I always plug it on every podcast or interview I'm doing and stuff. And one of these days we'll get to it, you know, but as you guys know, first responder schedules are plenty crazy. So trying to match up this rotation with this rotation, you know, it's like herding cats. You know?
Dude, I would love that. Like, that's the one thing, like Ski and I talk about music and just this idea. He always jokes about me being in a band with him, but I can't play any instruments and I cannot carry a tune in a bucket. I can't sing. So I can't really do anything with the band, but I would love to like listen to, I about said put a needle on the record, which I would, of a band of first responders like that who grew up in the scene. And can see and can bring that positivity.
Yeah. Know? I just, you know, here's the thing is like, I always like we'll use fire as an example. A lot of the, you know, firefighters, they really cling to the Dropkick Murphys, you know, we mm-hmm. always drop to like Boston Fire Department, you know, the Boston Hooligans and, mm-hmm. you know, and stuff, you know, and I was like, that's all cool. But that, you know, for me, that to me as a, being a punk guy, I was like, that's kind of cliche, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, and, I was like, but what if we gave it like all these first responders their own band that wasn't necessarily like, you know, the whole Irish punk thing. You know, we give like, mm-hmm. you know, like all these other first responders that are into bands like, you know, Bad Religion or Minor Threat, you know, something else besides having to, you know, put on a Scully cap and drink about, you know, sing songs about drinking and whatnot.
Yeah.
You know?
So, yeah.
I thought it'd be a good idea. Like, I was like, I would like to be that band that the, you know, our first responders who are into punk rock, you know, like kind of like cling on to us as their band, you know? And I was mm-hmm. like, you know, there's like so many crazy.
Uh-oh.
He froze.
No. All right. I was going to say Unit to Back when he's talking about, there we go.
All right, so like what I said,
I think we're breaking down our connection. So right. I was going to.
All right, so like we have the 7-inch, and we put like instructions on how to do CPR on the back of it. So when people buy a record, you know, it has this little thing just as like, this is how you do CPR, you know. Or whatnot, but just little things, little like informative, like public announcement things that we could slip into with like the records that, you know, someone's could be like, oh shoot, man, I got this responder record and now, you know, and on the back, it's telling me how to do chest compressions, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I was a kid, that was my thing, was music taught me to question everything. Right. And so that, like, let's say cause I was probably about, I don't know, middle school age, when I started really thinking about like cop work or being a police officer or whatever, and definitely the military. I always knew I like wanted to go in the military, but nobody in the punk scene was singing about being in the military, you know, or except maybe Suicidal Tendencies were saying join the army, but I don't know that was, you know what I mean? Like the best public announcement, but that I would dig that, man. Like that would be cool if like some kid also heard that record and was like, it is cool to be a firefighter. It is cool to be EMT or a cop or whatever. You know, this whole idea, this is punk rock. Like, this is changing your scene. This is contributing to helping others. Dude, you got to do that. Like, crank out some stuff. I want to hear it. I was going to say earlier, there's a clothing company called Unit to Back. Like, Unit with a number 2 and then Back. And I think that's what it is on Instagram. But it's a cop that actually makes police like themed shirts, but like he's got like, a circle shirt.
I think it's from here. I think I know her.
Okay, so yeah, everybody is kind of connected. Yes,
yep.
I think y'all yes. So they have a podcast called Punk Rock Cops, and so a couple of them started that, and then the guy that does Unit to Back. That his shirts have like the skank man from Circle Jerks, but it's actually like in a cop's uniform or whatever. It sounds weird, but then when you see it, it just works. Like the DRI, like old school logo, DRI.
See, that's we actually did the same thing. We have the skank man and he's got some tack pants on and he's holding, he's holding like his first in bag in one hand and holding a stethoscope in the other and stuff. And that's what, you know, like a shirt. I'll send that to you guys through Instagram, but I do have, I got to get going. I feel like I got to get onto my next, you know, I got that standby happening here.
In 1 minute,
so
yeah.
I really appreciate you guys having me on and stuff. I love this. I wish we could do longer because I could sit here and talk all night with you guys.
You're coming back, dude. Don't worry. You'll come back. Like, that's the thing. Like, we know our people, man, and you're one of our people. So you'll come back. I'll ask one last question and then I'll let you go.
All right.
Is there a band right now besides Minor Threat that people should check out or dig or whatever that maybe is a little more obscure?
So I would say, check out my brother's punk band and Restore.
Damn, can you say that again? It broke up.
Yeah, so I would say, like, not off the top of my head, because I'm pretty eclectic with music, and I'm like a guy that like just keeps listening to the same stuff. But check out my brother's band, System Restore. System Restore from Casper, Wyoming. I have an older brother. We played in bands together, you know, and great band. you know, he's got to plug family.
We'll do it, man. We'll do it. Well, I appreciate it, man. I'm glad we finally got to do it. I know you got to roll. You got to go do your thing. Ski, you got any bands to say?
I do, man. It's the holiday season. I've been listening to a lot of Trans-Siberian Orchestra.
Oh, okay. Hey,
the Rock Stars of Christmas, man.
That's good. That's good. I'll throw out there the Agrolites and Rocket from the Crypt. That's what I've been blasting recently.
Nice. But, you know, let me throw out this. Like, so if I could throw out a band, they're not a new band. They're not even together anymore, but check out Hour of the Wolf.
Hour of the Wolf?
Yep. Oh, that's shit. A band that Steve from Alpine Arms, he and I always talked about.
Okay. All right. Damn, he may have mentioned him before. Hour of the Wolf. I'll check him out, dude.
Hour of the Wolf.
Wolf. BC. Wolf. What's a wolf?
Huh? What'd I say? Wolf?
Wolf. Wolf. It's a wolf.
Man, you know my accent, dude. I can't say words. Don't ask me to go change that stuff that's in the engine.
Mark, I'll let you roll, man. Thank you so much for this.
Yeah.
Yeah, no problem, you guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, enjoy. Be careful.
All right. We'll see you guys. You too.
All right, buddy.
See you, brothers.
Disruptors out.
Later.